It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden is returning from a four-day diplomatic trip to the Middle East. We'll talk to a foreign affairs reporter about the impact of his talks with leaders from around the region. First, after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last month, some abortion opponents are renewing their focus on what's called fetal personhood. The movement's goal is to recognize the unborn as people under the law, granting them a right to life. Some legal experts say there are big legal and practical issues with fetal personhood, including making it possible to criminalize the actions of pregnant people. Personhood bills have been introduced in at least six states so far this year, according to the Guttmacher Institute, which supports abortion rights. An Arizona fetal personhood law was blocked in federal court last week. In 2020, a group of Wisconsin Republican lawmakers introduced a constitutional amendment that would grant fetal personhood in the state, but that amendment failed to move forward. You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea of fetal personhood? Do you want that law to come into existence here in Wisconsin, nationwide? What questions do you have about what it would mean for pregnant women in particular? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mary Ziegler is an expert on the law, history, and politics of reproduction and the debate over abortion in the United States. Her latest book is Dollars for Life, the Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. She's a law professor at the University of California, Davis. Mary, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk more about what fetal personhood would mean in practice?
Well, one of the, I think, interesting questions is we don't know entirely, right? There are different versions of fetal personhood that can be written into the law. The most basic premise of personhood is basically that abortion itself is unconstitutional. So if there were a personhood law in Wisconsin or a personhood law nationally or the Supreme Court recognized personhood, that would mean that states no longer would have the ability to say that they wanted abortion to be legal. Voters, you know, if you went directly to voters, would no longer be able to say they wanted abortion to be legal. It would essentially create a right, a fetal right that states and voters couldn't override. What else it would mean is more uncertain. Most states or folks who've defined personhood have described it as, you know, life beginning at fertilization and rights kicking in at fertilization. That raises interesting questions about whether some contraceptives would be banned, about whether the practice of infertility treatments would have to change fundamentally when we're thinking about things like in vitro fertilization or the storage of embryos. It may even mean changes to how census data are taken, how dependents are defined on tax returns, who's owed child support. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Let's talk some about the timing here. As this is the phrase is usually fetal personhood. As I understand it, a fetus isn't defined until like the 11th week of pregnancy. Before that, it's an embryo. Before that, it's a zygote. When people talk about passing laws like this, though, as you just mentioned, do they usually mean at conception?
Yes. Yeah, that's usually the argument, right? To the extent states have started using explicit definitions of personhood, it's often at fertilization. There are exceptions to that. So you may remember around 2019, a variety of states across the South and Midwest banned abortion at 6 weeks on the theory that that's when fetal heartbeat or fetal cardiac activity could be detected. Georgia actually created fetal rights and personhood at 6 weeks as an extension of that law. But most, I think, generally within the anti-abortion movement in many states that are trying to move on personhood, it's fertilization of an egg when personhood begins.
And the fertilization, I mean, this is implantation happens, again, as I understand it, 6 to 12 days after that. Fertilization is a very narrow, I guess, definition here. Can you talk about the impact that could have in particular, that window between fertilization and implantation on things like, as you mentioned, what we generally consider as birth control?
Right. So there's a dispute about how some common contraceptives actually work. So there are kind of two levels of disagreement here. One is a disagreement about when personhood begins and or what abortion means. And another is a disagreement about how specific drugs actually work. So IUDs and emergency contraceptives are believed by some to prevent the implantation of a fertilized egg, which would make those abortifacients or make those violative of fetal rights, according to people who believe that. There are some folks who also think that even the birth control pill prevents implantation of a fertilized egg. It's worth emphasizing that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists disagrees with all of that and says that the, both, you know, emergency contraceptives and the birth control pill and IUDs work by preventing or delaying ovulation, not by preventing implantation. But because many believe that it does prevent implantation, that could result in these laws applying to birth control methods or what we often think of as birth control methods.
We're talking to Mary Ziegler, law professor at the University of California, Davis, looking at the idea of fetal personhood laws, defining under, say, state constitutions in some instances that life would begin at conception and grant a certain battery of rights to the zygote, the embryo, the fetus along the way, limiting abortion and raising a lot of legal questions along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your calls, with your questions for our guest. Again, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Deborah is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Deborah, hi.
Hi. Personhood for fetuses is like the height of hypocrisy because they don't really care about life. It's about controlling women. It's about misogyny and patriarchy. And that's pretty much my comment.
Deborah, thanks for the call. Mary, Deborah raises a question. She raises the concern of control over women. And people who are worried about fetal personhood laws say, well, wait, what power is that going to give, say, a state to regulate the activities of a pregnant woman? What kind of, again, we don't have these laws in place now. What kind of concerns are out there?
Well, I mean, I think that the people who are the wing of the anti-abortion movement that's the most invested in the idea of actually punishing pregnant women. So in other words, most state laws now focus on punishing doctors. And that's true in Wisconsin as well as elsewhere. States that have more recent abortion bans than Wisconsin's, which is obviously an older law, had maybe expanded that to include a broad group of folks defined as accomplices. So think about, you know, the mom driving her daughter to an appointment or somebody donating to an abortion fund, but they still don't reach the patient. The people who are pushing to criminalize the patient are the people who say, you know, personhood requires absolute equal treatment of a fetus or zygote or embryo and anybody else. So in other words, if it would be a crime to intentionally kill, you know, a 10-year-old or a 30-year-old, it should be the same kind of crime, meaning a homicide, to have an abortion. And the person that should extend not only to the doctor, but to the person choosing the abortion. So I think there's a fear for some that the more personhood is recognized, the more not only you'll have the kind of control over women's lives, you know, that arguably comes with any abortion ban, you also would have direct efforts to punish women, which is not a guarantee, but it's certainly true that the people who are the what are called the abortion abolitionists, the people who push that argument on kind of strict equal treatment the most, are also the people who are calling for the punishment of women and other people who are pregnant.
Another concern I've seen raised is, say, in the instance of someone who's pregnant and is diagnosed with cancer, if a cancer treatment would put the fetus, say, at risk along the way, would they then have to delay chemotherapy, radiation treatment, that kind of thing?
Yeah, potentially, right? And I mean, you wouldn't even need personhood to get to that. This really depends on the scope of the like life of the pregnant person exceptions or life of the mother exceptions that exist in state laws. Wisconsin Right to Life, my understanding, is opposed to such exceptions on the ground that there are no scenarios, according to the group, in which abortion is life-saving. They tend to argue that abortion is the intentional taking of a fetal life. So if you just happen to have a fetus or an unborn child or an embryo die because you're trying to save somebody's life and you're making, as they would put it, every reasonable effort to save the fetal life, sometimes things happen. But this idea of no intentional taking a fetal life ever, even to save somebody else's life, is a shift and could affect access to a variety of treatment, right? It could mean delays. It could mean lack of access to treatment for patients who are pregnant in a variety of settings, right? Not, as you mentioned, not just people who are seeking abortions, but people who are pregnant who are getting other kinds of treatment.
We're talking to Mary Ziegler, professor of law at the University of California, Davis, and expert on reproductive law, with us today for a closer look at the fetal personhood movement, what it could mean for families, healthcare, birth control, and society. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this idea of fetal personhood? Would you want to see it become a part of the Constitution in Wisconsin, part of the United States Constitution? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about fetal personhood, some of the legal and practical implications of granting personhood status starting at conception, where the movement stands with the constitutional right to an abortion overturned now. Law professor Mary Ziegler at the University of California, Davis, is with us, and you can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Rob is with us in La Crosse. Hi, Rob. Are you there, Rob?
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, there you are. Go ahead, Rob.
Oh, okay, sorry.
And, nope, I think we lost Rob. Thanks for trying, though. We'll go to Loretta, then in Wausau. Loretta, hi.
Hi, Rob. Yeah, I wanted to say I do not think that abortion should be criminalized, but I also think that life does begin at conception. It's biologically and philosophically, it's life, and it's none other than human life, according to its DNA. But it's the mother's unique moral situation to decide what to do about that pregnancy.
Loretta, thanks a lot for the call and sharing your thoughts. Mary, Loretta reminding me that a lot of people have nuanced opinions on abortion, not all pro or con, some gray areas for people. What do you think of what Loretta had to say?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me, Americans United for Life did a poll with YouGov recently on fetal rights and basically asked Americans, you know, are you supportive of some kind of protections for life in the womb? And they found a majority of people said yes. And then they said, are you also supportive of restrictions on abortion? And they found that the number of people who responded yes to that question was much, much lower than the people who said, I want some kind of protection for life. And all of that goes to show that even if you think that, you know, that personhood begins at fertilization, or even, you know, not just life, maybe even some kind of rights begin at fertilization, that doesn't necessarily mean you support criminalizing abortion. Those two things in recent history have gone together, but I mean, that was neither historically inevitable, and it still really isn't. So Loretta's comment reminded me of that.
Loretta, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tate joins us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tate.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just have a question, because I know for everyone you talk to, you're going to get a different answer on when life actually begins. But as from the perspective of our government, don't you have to be born to get a Social Security number? So why wouldn't, from a legal point of view, that be when the individual life begins at birth?
Tate, thanks for the call. Mary, Social Security numbers for people this is a question that has come up. Would people need to get Social Security numbers before they're born?
Yeah, well, one interesting thing, obviously, about Roe being overturned is it throws this question to individual states. And so, you know, Arizona, which already has a personhood measure, as you mentioned, has a different definition of when personhood begins and when certain rights attach that may be in tension with the one that the Social Security Administration has and the federal government. So it also opens up interesting and complicated possibilities about, you know, what happens when federal definitions of personhood clash with state personhood definitions, and when do we think the federal government was trying to, you know, kind of take precedence, and when do we think they weren't? And I mean, we don't, we don't really know how those kinds of conflicts will be resolved, because Roe v. Wade had settled this for so many years that we have a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of legal gray areas.
Tate, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Danny is with us now in Waukon, Iowa. Danny, hi.
Hi there. This kind of might have been touched on by your last caller, but I was curious if life and, say, personhood begins at conception, at what point can the mother start collecting child support payments from the father, if that's an issue, and also if they have a Social Security number, are they able to be claimed on the mother's tax return and get the child tax credit before they're born and things like that?
Danny, thanks for the call. Big open questions, Mary.
Yeah, I mean, these, again, are things that are not really very well addressed. So in some states that have defined personhood, as I mentioned, Georgia has this thing that kicks in at 6 weeks. Georgia lawmakers have explicitly said, by the way, we do mean that this kicks in for the purposes of child support and taxes and the census. So we know that in Georgia, if that law goes into effect, it would at least cover those things. The problem, of course, is that states, if it's just left up to the states, states can define personhood or constitutional personhood however they want, and they may, as many states have, just have some sort of free-floating idea that personhood and rights begin at fertilization without spelling out what that means for anything like child support or the census or taxes. So I think often you just sort of have to stay tuned, unless it's a case like Georgia's. And I don't mean to make Georgia sound as if it's dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's either. It's just they've spelled out a handful of ramifications while leaving a lot of the rest, you know, to be determined.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Mary Ziegler, law professor at the University of California, Davis, about the concept of fetal personhood, what it means for abortion, but not just abortion, as we're hearing a lot of other legal changes, a lot of legal consequences if these laws start coming into effect around the country. Kate joins us now in Madison. Kate, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for calling. I just had a question since we had a legal scholar on the line. So I'm a person too. I'm a person that can get pregnant. Isn't it discriminatory if I don't receive life-saving care, but somebody else who cannot get pregnant is allowed to receive life-saving care?
Kate, thanks.
Yeah,
go ahead, Mary.
Sorry. Yeah. I mean, so yes, I think that's correct. We know under federal law that, you know, pregnancy discrimination is a violation of federal civil rights law. It counts as a form of sex discrimination. And in fact, you know, there have been some signs that the Justice Department is going to vigorously take this position. We know that when pharmacists, for example, have been refusing medications to people because they're pregnant on the theory that they may be used for abortions, the Justice Department is taking the position that that's a civil rights violation. That's a form of discrimination. You can make the same argument with respect to life-saving medical treatment, you know, essentially the idea that discrimination on the basis of pregnancy is, you know, unconstitutional or is a violation of basic principles of equality on the basis of sex and other things. Having said all that, I don't think the U.S. Supreme Court buys that argument. The court had said in the 70s that pregnancy discrimination for the purposes of the Constitution, right, not for federal civil rights law, is not unconstitutional, right? That pregnancy discrimination is not sex discrimination and is okay from a constitutional standpoint. And the court, I think, has tried to say states have an interest in protecting fetal life that justifies treating pregnant people differently from other people, even potentially, although the Supreme Court hasn't weighed in on this, when it comes to life-saving care. So I think the answer legally depends on if you're talking about federal civil rights law, where that argument may really have teeth, and it's why we've already seen the Biden Justice Department flagging their interest in it, versus if we're talking about constitutional law. Of course, again, you know, you always have to look at who's interpreting the law, not just what it is. And given that we have the Supreme Court that we have with the positions that the court has on abortion, you know, you might wonder if the federal civil rights claim would work either.
Thanks for that call. Mary, I want to follow up on that. We've mostly been focusing on the idea of fetal rights, rights starting at conception. Can you talk more about what these laws coming into place could mean for the rights of women during pregnancy, women of childbearing years? What could this all mean for them?
Well, if abortion is unconstitutional, obviously that's kind of like a supercharged version of abortion just being illegal. And in order, the kind of interesting question then becomes, well, how does a state enforce a law like that, given that abortion medication is easy to come by on the internet, and it can be ordered not only from more progressive states, it can be ordered from outside the United States altogether. So I think what that could mean, and again, we're just beginning to see how this is going to play out, is that people of reproductive age may be surveyed more by law enforcement. We've already seen concerns raised in particular about digital privacy, about how people's online lives could be used to enforce criminal abortion laws. So for example, you know, what are called geofence warrants, like information people can get from your smartphone or your GPS about where you're traveling, information like data you may enter in period trackers, text messages you may enter that are unencrypted, social media posts or direct messages, emails, all of these kinds of reams of digital data, which are already being mined by companies that sell data to targeted advertisers, right? The folks where you, when you see, you know, a million ads for a vacuum cleaner when you just bought one, if that's being sold to targeted advertisers, it could also be sold or made available to law enforcement. As our caller from Madison suggested, it can affect people's access, and I think we already discussed too, emergency medical treatment for anyone who's pregnant. It can affect access to medications that could be used as abortifacients, including for people who are not pregnant at all, right? I mean, you sometimes see people of reproductive age being denied access to medications for something like lupus on the theory that those drugs could be used as abortifacients. And a lot of this is happening with or without, it's worth emphasizing, the intention of conservative lawmakers, because part of what's happened is that, unlike Wisconsin's law, which is an older law, the newer abortion bans have penalties much harsher than anything we saw in the 19th century, right?
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest law professor, Mary Ziegler, from the University of California, Davis, looking at the concept of fetal personhood. Coming up after the news, a look at President Biden's diplomatic visit to the Middle East. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the first woman to hike all 11 National Scenic Trails just accomplished her goal here in Wisconsin. We'll talk to her about her time on the Ice Age Trail and what's next. Now, President Biden spent 4 days on a diplomatic trip through the Middle East late last week and into the weekend, meeting with leaders of Israel and Saudi Arabia, among others. Biden said the trip was an effort to strengthen relations in the region in opposition to Iran, China, and Russia. The president is facing some criticism domestically for his handling of Israel and Saudi Arabia because of concerns over human rights. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you follow President Biden's trip to the Middle East? Do you think it's important for him to build better relations with these countries? Do you think he handled the trip well? What would you like to see gone differently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nahal Tusi is a senior correspondent for foreign affairs and national security at Politico. Nahal, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What stood out to you the most about this presidential visit to the Middle East?
Well, I guess it had to be the fist bump. I really hate to admit that. I mean, it seems like you would think I'd talk about policy or something like that. But honestly, just seeing that visual of President Biden giving a fist bump to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, that really did stand out for me. And it's the visual that I'm going to keep with me for a long time.
Let's give a listen to President Biden addressing Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman, talking about the killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. We don't have that audio. Okay. Well, the president had said back in 2019 he would make Saudi Arabia a pariah. Use the word pariah over human rights violations, including the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. Now, here he is. How could you? And that's the significance, I think, of that fist bump. How did he try to thread that needle?
Yeah, look, it just basically came down to reality, right? Which is that there are certain countries at certain times that the United States feels that it will need for advancing its national interest. And the Biden administration sees Saudi Arabia as a critical partner, as have plenty of presidential administrations in the past in the Middle East. And it's not just because of oil and the price shocks that we've been experiencing because of Russia's war on Ukraine, but also because of the regional threat posed by Iran and the literal central location of that country in a place where the food security situation has an impact. And the Chinese and Russian interest, of course, in maintaining relations with the Saudis. So, you know, it's a country that's been a partner for a long time. And yes, it does have this de facto ruler with a lot of blood on its hands. But the sense of the Biden administration was, after all this time, that, look, we just have to engage them one way or another. And you could also argue that ignoring them doesn't really help the advance the cause of human rights either, that if you engage them and talk to them and say, hey, maybe you should stop killing journalists, that maybe that'll have more impact than just declaring them a pariah and trying not to deal with them.
You wrote a piece recently on Mohammed bin Salman, looking at whether he had changed as a ruler, whether he could get, I guess, better from a human rights perspective over time. What kind of things are you looking at?
Yeah, I mean, look, this guy, he's in his 30s. And the first time I wrote about him was actually back in 2015 when he was the deputy crown prince and he had just kind of come out of nowhere. And everybody was like, who is this guy? But he'd already, you know, been launching a war in Yemen and doing these things. And everyone really in Washington, really nobody knew who he was. And now he's basically running Saudi Arabia, although his father is still the king, but his father is quite old and the son is doing all the work. And he's so young that, you know, there is a sense in Congress and beyond that he could be around for another 50 years and we have to learn to deal with him and we have to understand what he's like and how or whether we can shape him. But the interesting thing is it's hard to say if you can shape him because now he's what, in his mid to late 30s, he's never actually really, he's never lived outside Saudi Arabia, unlike a lot of many other Arab elites who get their schooling in the West. They, you know, go to places like Harvard and Georgetown. They get these slots. Mohammed bin Salman went to university in Saudi Arabia. He doesn't have as much exposure to the West. And so he doesn't seem to quite understand why people react the way they do when he does things like abduct the prime minister of Lebanon, which he did a few years ago. So, you know, it's like there's a disconnect. And the question is, has he, after the backlash over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi and the, you know, temporary freeze out under the Biden administration, has he learned a lesson? Does he know he can, can he change, basically? Can he become a more responsible ruler? And, you know, what some people tell me is, you're not really going to change his personality that much at this stage, but he does seem to be more respectful of process. He does seem to be more understanding that his actions will have consequences. And you have to remember, this is a guy who grew up a Saudi royal, you know, clearly a favorite son. He could get away with just about anything growing up. And now it's clear that on the global stage, he can't just get away with it. Although you could argue that Biden going there and seeing him and giving him a fist bump and maybe makes him think he can get away with it.
And you mentioned that Saudi Arabia isn't important just because of oil, but the oil is pretty important. And we've got the situation now with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. High oil prices help Russia and hurt the West. And one hope from Biden's visit, I think, was to get Saudi Arabia to push for more expansion of oil, bring down those prices, hurt Russia, help the West. Did anything come out of that?
Actually, no. I mean, nothing major. And that's one of the amazing things. Look, a while ago, the Saudis and some of the Arab states agreed to have some limited increase in production. And it seems like that's basically about it. And so we did not hear any new agreement on expanded production or anything coming out of this Biden trip. And that's partly because from what we're told, you know, the Saudis, they only have so much capacity to increase anyway. Like, it's not like they necessarily are doing it out of or not doing it out of spite. There are certain limitations. And so, no, there actually was not some major breakthrough on energy. Now, it is possible there were other steps that were made, things behind the scenes that really could matter over time and that maybe we just don't know yet. But no, I mean, in terms of a big deal that could like affect the high oil prices and things, no, we haven't really seen anything like that.
We're talking to Nehal Tusi, national security correspondent at Politico, looking at President Biden's four-day trip to the Middle East. You could join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from the White House when it comes to Saudi Arabia? How about Israel? Are you paying attention to the latest news in the Middle East, or is all your foreign policy oxygen, like a lot of the media, being sucked up by what's going on in Russia and Ukraine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Nehal, that was Saudi Arabia. Another big visit was to Israel, and the current leadership of Israel, subject to change, I think, pretty soon with another in a series of elections on the way. Can you talk about that meeting?
Yes. The Israelis love to boast that they are the only real democracy in the Middle East, and they are definitely proving it with all these elections that they're having. They're about to have a fifth in less than 4 years. But President Biden went to Israel first. It was a really key part of the trip. And actually, in many ways, Israel is the big winner from this entire trip. Throughout the Biden administration, Israel has basically gotten everything that it wanted, nearly everything. The Biden administration, either because it can't legally or politically, it's just too explosive, it has been unable to reopen the consulate that dealt with the Palestinians. It has not been able to revive the nuclear deal with Iran, something that Israel opposes. There's just been so many steps. And even the meeting with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia was actually a victory for Israel, because Israel really wants the U.S. and Saudi Arabia to get along better, because it is trying to improve its ties to Saudi Arabia, and in the hopes that over time it can establish diplomatic relations with them. Joe Biden went there. He was received very well. He loves Israel. He's always been a diehard Israel supporter, and they received him with a lot of happiness, and it went quite well for him. And yeah, for the Israelis, this was a really great trip.
And a key country here that didn't get a visit is Iran. Israel, Saudi Arabia, other Sunni-led countries very worried about Iran's influence agenda in the region. How central was Iran in these meetings?
Oh, man, the day that a U.S. president goes to Iran, that will be a seismic shift. Iran is definitely not getting a presidential visit anytime soon. It remains the number one adversary in the Middle East in the eyes of the U.S., as well as in the eyes of the Israelis and many of its Arab partners. Iran, in many ways, has become a unifying factor, kind of the common enemy that has united Arab states with Israel. It's continuing to, cause all sorts of issues. It has a number of proxy militias and militant groups and terrorist organizations that it supports throughout the Middle East. It continues with its nuclear program, although that is a complicated issue. It's still considered a major threat, and the U.S. has not been able to convince it to revive the nuclear deal that it had struck a few years back, and which President Trump abandoned. Iran remains a major concern. I don't see any major breakthroughs, though, coming with that. I don't know what the plan is. And I do, believe me, I ask a lot. That's a question I ask a lot of U.S. officials in Washington. Hey, what's the plan? And, often I just don't get an answer.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Neenah. Brian, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The optics of the fist bump, I don't sanction everything that led up to, the killing or anything like that, obviously. But, so much attention has been paid to this fist bump, and we hope that we are going to find some return that's going to ultimately help our country. At the same time, I don't hear any of those voices reflecting back to when we gave legitimacy to Kim Jong-un, where there was genocide in the entire country, yet we went there for optics only. And we got nothing out of it. So I'm curious as to your speaker and comparing the two.
Brian, thanks for the call. Brian, I think referring to President Trump's high-profile meeting with Kim Jong-un. You wrote, I think, in your MBS piece about President Trump and the orb in his Saudi Arabia visit. Compare and contrast, Nehal.
Yeah, look, those were both very important visits. I mean, the Kim Jong-un visits were historic. I mean, unprecedented. No U.S. president, sitting U.S. president, had ever sat down with, met with a North Korean leader. Um, and it was a wild shot by President Trump in hopes of breaking some taboos and trying to make some headway. He would argue, President Trump would, that he actually did lower the temperature with North Korea and that we did get something out of it, which was we were, you know, on the verge of like some pretty heated moments with North Korea initially under President Trump, but that most of the rest of his term, like things calmed down and the North Koreans didn't really make too much noise. So, I mean, he would argue that there was something out of that. Now, I remember, I will tell you this, I personally wrote a number of stories about the human rights element of that trip and how when President Trump went there and met him and they acted like they were best friends. They met in Singapore, just to be clear, initially, that it was a real blow to the human rights efforts, especially because there were so many people who are held in gulags or otherwise being poorly treated in North Korea, which is closest thing that the world has to a totalitarian state. So yeah, no, look, there was a lot of coverage of that. I think it's given how much coverage there was of everything, it might be hard to kind of remember all of that at the same time. But no, there are definite parallels. I will say, I think the Saudi Arabia is a much more integrated into the world economy, though, than North Korea is. And so there's a huge difference there.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about President Biden's trip to the Middle East this weekend with Politico senior foreign affairs correspondent Nahal Tusi. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think about President Biden's meeting with Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman? Do you think the president should have been more publicly firm about concerns with the Saudis and human rights issues? Do you want to see the U.S. have a better relationship with Saudi Arabia? How about Israel? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Nahal Tusi, senior foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. With us today, looking at the impacts of President Biden's weekend trip to meet with leaders in the Middle East. A lot of focus on Saudi Arabia and on Israel. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want the U.S. to handle its relations in the Middle East? How important do you think this region is for U.S. global interests? What question do you have about this visit? Do you want to see more support for Israel or less? What about the Palestinians, Saudi Arabia? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nahal, something you touched on earlier, the White House has made the case that, hey, if we're not there in the Middle East, the Chinese and the Russians certainly will be. What kind of diplomatic efforts do you see from Russia and China in the region?
Oh, well, there's always ongoing outreach to those countries. I mean, they have important ties. There's visits and, you know, the diplomats are always in touch. They're always looking for Chinese in particular. They're always looking for trade deals. Forgive me. There's constant ongoing outreach with the countries, but it's also in terms of weapon sales and things like that. And I think that's, you know, all of those are areas where the U.S. does not want to lose the Arab states to the orbit of those other countries. And part of it is actually because we want to sell them weapons as well. So those things all do factor in. I think it's going to be, you know, in many ways, the whole setup they have over there, especially when it comes to their weapons, is kind of configured to be more compatible with the West and the United States. So it's hard for them to simply pivot and, you know, turn to Chinese and Russian made efforts on everything. But it's not impossible. And they are, again, they are oil wealthy countries. They're trying to sell their oil. So if China in particular wants to buy more oil, they're going to do it. They're going to sell them the oil. I mean, it is part of it's just business.
Now, a big part of the story here, and you've touched on this as well, Nahal, the Abraham Accords. Now, this is a diplomatic effort under the Trump administration, kind of one-to-one agreements between Israel and particular Arab countries in the Middle East. This is something that the Biden administration is maybe trying to build on from their predecessor. One of the few cases, foreign or domestic, where they're trying to build on something from the Trump administration.
Yes, that's right. These accords established diplomatic relations between Israel and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice.
That's okay. We all been there.
and Sudan and Morocco. And yeah, the Biden administration says that it's trying to build on these things. They're trying to get more countries to sign on to these accords. I've heard everything from Indonesia to the Comoros, sorry, to Oman and beyond. But honestly, I'm a little surprised they haven't gotten another country yet. I don't think the Saudis are going to sign on anytime soon. That doesn't mean that they're not going to take steps to kind of get closer to Israel de facto. You know, they might do things like, I mean, for instance, they did just open their skies to Israeli planes, right? So they're going to, I think the Saudis will do certain things, but officially, are they going to sign a piece of paper? I don't think that'll happen anytime soon. But there might be other countries that in the next year or so, we could see officially sign on. It remains to be seen.
Talking to Nihal Tusi, senior correspondent for foreign affairs and national security at Politico, looking at President Biden's four-day visit in the Middle East late last week and into the weekend. Big meetings with leaders in Saudi Arabia and Israel, looking at what happened, what was said, what, if anything, the U.S. got out of it. You can join in, still a little time, at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Superior. Bill, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. So the stop in Israel and the talks about strengthening ties, everybody knows it's common sense to why he went over there. The stop in Israel was just kind of like a little side shoot to the fact that he was going over to Saudi Arabia with his hand out to beg for oil from foreign entities, because he doesn't want to own the mistakes of completely trying to block all natural resource production and oil in the United States to try to get rid of it in the United States. But yet, let's go beg foreign countries for it. It's absolutely pathetic.
Bill, thanks for the call. Oil production is still pretty high here in the U.S., Nihal, but how much of this was handout begging for more oil?
You know, I mean, they say that it wasn't as much about oil as we, you know, the observers believe that it was. The administration really downplayed the oil aspect of it. But I think it was pretty clear that that is a big part of it. I mean, the high oil prices are affecting President Biden's poll figures. And, you know, the domestic politics aspect of this is huge. But that being said, yes, the U.S. remains, last I checked, it's the top oil producer in the world. And that hasn't changed. It's just that the war in Ukraine has just nonetheless affected confidence, affected prices. And frankly, you know, oil companies like are using this moment to make money. And I think that's one of the frustrations that the Biden administration has as well, is they just feel like the oil companies could take steps to lower the prices on their own, that they don't have to be raking in all these profits. But look, yeah, he went there. Oil was a factor, even despite his efforts to deny that or downplay it. But did they get some big oil deal out of it? No. And can the Gulf states really ramp up their production that much more to make much of a difference? My understanding is that they really can't. I mean, just because you have a bunch of oil does not mean that you can actually just, you know, put it on the market the next day. It's actually super complicated. It depends on everything from the type of oil to the refineries, to your capacity, to the people, the amount of money. I mean, it's expensive and it's hard, and it's a very, very intense and complicated field. And so I don't get the sense that he had that much luck, but the administration also has a long-term view of this. I mean, this isn't just about today or tomorrow. I mean, they're hoping for a second Biden term. So they want to think long-term about the relationship as well.
Thanks for that call. And just our last half minute, Nihal, what are you watching for next?
That's a good question. I guess I'm going to, you know, I can tell you, I'm going to keep an eye on human rights issues in the Middle East and in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and some of these countries that the U.S. is reaching out to. I'm going to see, now that there has been this outreach, what is Mohammed bin Salman going to do? Is he going to release some political prisoners, or are we going to continue to see ongoing crackdowns? I can't say that I am hopeful given their track record, but anything is possible.
Nihal, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Nihal Tusi, senior correspondent for foreign affairs and national security at Politico. She was with us today to share what we learned from President Biden's meetings this weekend in the Middle East, especially his visits to Saudi Arabia and Israel along the way. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some plastics are easier to recycle than others. Find out why recycling programs are often struggling to keep up with the never-ending flow of plastic waste. And you could join in with your questions, maybe your own observations. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Pikes Peak in Colorado is a famous mountain, but it isn't known as one of the great challenges in mountain climbing. That's not to say it's easy, especially if you do it while pushing a peanut with your nose. As reported by our colleagues at Colorado Public Radio, a guy from Colorado Springs did exactly that. Over the course of 7 days, he made it to the peak of Pikes Peak, pushing a peanut with his nose. 7 days is a new record, which means, yes, there was an old record. This is the fourth time someone made it to the top of Pikes Peak, pushing a peanut with their nose. Some additional facts. From a picture, it looks like he wore this face-mounted device crafted specifically to help someone push a peanut uphill. Not a high-demand product. Also, it was the same climber all the way, but not the same peanut. Apparently, the rules allow you to use replacement peanuts. Sometimes they fall into cracks and whatnot, so you don't have to go back to the start. Anybody want to try this on Tim's Hill, the highest point in Wisconsin? Bonus points if you can get the peanut up the stairs on the observation tower. You've got to push a peanut or two, kids. This is Central Time.